This evening will be in the first chapter of James. And this came about when I was working on the lesson for this morning this week. It kicked off some other ideas that I'd like to share with you all. When we look at verses 2 through 12 in James chapter 1, we might consider rephrasing the old hymn, "Consider your trials, name them one by one. Count your many trials and see what God has done." When we come to realize that God is able to work good in the midst of the trials, that these same trials that oftentimes get us down can be used to make us more like Christ. And when we look at it this way, our view of trials will change. This is one of the things that all of us Christians and people all over the world have in common. But it's startling to learn that trials can be added up on the credit side instead of the debit side. They're going to come. It might be tomorrow. We most definitely are going to face some kind of trials this coming week. But the important question is, and this is why it came to me in working on this morning's lesson, is what will our attitude be when they do come? There is one thing that is certain. Our trials will either draw us closer to God, or they were going to make us bitter. A man by the name of Thomas Carlyle once said, "The ultimate question posed by life is, will you be a hero or a coward?" Job's wife wanted him to be a coward. Job 2 in verse 9, it says, "Curse God and die." That was her solution to what he was going through. But in the midst of our groaning and sometimes even our self-pity, if we would turn to the first chapter of James, we would find help. Because James, through these things, tells us to count our trials as though they were joyful experiences. He tells us that we are all going to deal and endure trials. For me, and many for many of you, counting them as joyful experiences is foreign. And even though the Bible is an old book, we still have not learned of its wisdom. The reason that I say that we should look at trials as things of joy is because trials give us a victorious faith. Verse 3 of James 1 reminds us that trials are the trying of our faith. And maybe that's one of the things we need to consider in the back of our minds when we ask for God to increase our faith, then we need to use that as a warning. If we ask God to increase our faith, we also need to ask Him His help, because trials are going to come to test that faith. And oftentimes, the greater faith that we have, the more trial, or the harder the trial will be. It's not that God is sitting there trying to trip us up. But just as God allowed Satan to try Job, because Job was a righteous man, he was a very faithful man, God knew he could withstand. But you know, there is a wonderful byproduct that occurs when our faith is tested. And we don't often consider this a byproduct. But that byproduct is patience. Now, we usually like to think of patience as fishing all day without getting a bite. To me, fishing is an escape. They call it fishing and not catching. But that kind of patience is not what James had in mind. Biblical patience is endurance. It is steadfastness. It is not waiting for a fish to bite. It's kind of like the soldier who is carrying this heavy rucksack on his back for miles and miles, and he's always going forward one step at a time. But sadly for many people, and especially even Christians, they start to give up. They start to take the things out of their backpack that will help them survive because they're burdened and weighed down. And before they know it, they have become deserted and their packs are empty. And when you ask them why, we get all kinds of excuses. Somebody insulted me and hurt my feelings. I'm ignored. It could be a tragedy. But whatever the excuse, any surrender is a small one. It is patience that is the staying power when life piles up on top of us. And James assures us that steadfast patience works out in us as a complete Christian maturity. In verse 4, it says, "And let steadfastness," in the King James, patience, "have its full effect, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." When we allow faith's trials to produce this endurance, this spirit of endurance will mold us into a fully mature Christian. But I must warn you, it is a very painful process. It is like undergoing surgery without anesthesia. It's going to hurt. There is not a single child who has ever grown up to be a man or a woman unless they have endured the bumps and bruises and many chastenings and many trials. The only alternative to faithful Christian endurance is not only to follow the advice of Job's wife, to curse God and die. It is also to be guilty of Satan's accusation that Job only served God because of what he got out of it. But I had to ask myself a question this week, and I believe it was a good question, because I was sitting there looking at, okay, well, this is great. Now, how do I do it? How do I face the trials that we face in such a way that our faith is strengthened and our endurance is manifested? And fortunately for us Christians, we do have the resources available. To begin with, a certain attitude is basic. For you see, it's not natural to look at trials as blessings. And James recognized the difficulty. And that is, I believe, the reason why he wrote verse 5. That if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given to him. See, it's wisdom that allows us to have the ability to recognize our trials as blessings. Wisdom involves an understanding of the importance of the moral and the eternal. It means an evaluation of life that realizes pleasure is not a sound standard for weighing life. An abiding happiness is brought to its completion by being molded into the likeness of Christ. When we look at it in this light, many of the happy times, or at least what we consider to be the happy times, should be put on the debit side of the ledger. Because oftentimes those happy times that we count as happy times have separated us from God. Sometimes a better job or even a promotion belongs on the debit side because it takes us away and too busy to serve God. Since wisdom is God-given, it can only come through prayer. As James had indicated, if you want this kind of wisdom, you must ask God for it. But we need to be warned. We must not ask God for such an outlook unless we really want it. For God gives it liberally and without reproach. Our banker may feel that we haven't handled our finances properly, so he may deny us a loan. When we asked God for wisdom to see the real values of life and of the trials, he is going to give it to us liberally. The moral wisdom in question is a great deficiency in the Christian life. Oftentimes, it's the sum of practical living. It is being able to discern between earthly and heavenly. But once we obtain it, wisdom casts its light on a life that we will never again desire to live, those paths of unrighteousness, those luxuries of irresponsibility. Maybe I can put it this way a little bit better, that makes it easier to understand. There is no reason whatsoever in asking God to make us a good doctor or a good lawyer unless we are willing to go to school and apply ourselves. Neither is there any purpose in asking God for an outlook and wisdom that demands a change in our values unless we are willing for our values to be changed. I hope that kind of makes sense. When I was sitting there trying to put it and wrap my brain around it, it came to me. For that's what James had in mind in verses 6 through 8. But let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is double-minded, unstable in all his ways. We're being warned not to pray for an outlook that we really don't want. This makes prayer a joke. It's like praying to God to make us Christ-like when our true desire is to be more worldly. The word that we find in the King James, the wavering, literally means to be torn between two judgments or sets of values. To pray in faith is to pray in total commitment. There is no place in prayer for indecision as to the object that we desire. This indecision is like an uncertain wave or a wavering sea or a rogue wave. It goes one way and then the other. You don't know which direction it's going to be coming at you. The double-minded man is the one with two souls, who has yet to decide what kind of man he wants to be. Not only do trials make possible that victorious faith, but they also erase man-made distinctions and values. James is actually a very easy book to understand in its principles. He makes this, verses 9 through 11, he uses the matter of poverty and wealth as an illustration. Let the lowly brother boast in his exaltation, and the rich in his humiliation, because as the flower of the grass he will pass away, for the sun rises with its scorching heat, and the grass, its flower falls, and its beauty perishes. So also the rich man will fade away in the midst of his pursuit. So what's he telling me? That the lowly brother is good, the rich guy is bad? No, not at all. He's trying to tell us that the rich man or the poor man should see that through Christ, he is exalted as a child of God. And that the rich man should see that in Christ, he is no richer than anyone else. Both of those, the lowly brother and the rich man, need to see that their worth depends upon serving God, and that faith erases the despondency of the poor, but it also erases the pride of the rich. We need to see that all of life quickly wilts, like the summer grass in the scorching sun. The song that we sang earlier points that out. And sometimes we say, and then we die, it's kind of like, whoa. But it's true. We live this life. God blesses us with however many years we have. Whether it's a couple of weeks or 80, 90, 100 years, we are blessed with the life that He has given us. But it will all eventually go away. The trials that we face in our lives has a way of sweeping away the temporary tinsel that embellishes so much of life. It points out to us, these trials, that there are things that really count. And because of the trials, we are richer because of them. Trials are a reminder that we cannot take any of it with us. Contrary to popular opinion, trials places a crown of life on us that nothing else can. Verse 12 of James 1. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial. For when he stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. The promise involves a crown of life. Now, there are different levels of and different degrees of life. For some, life never rises above the animal level. But to a child of God, life takes on a different light. Every trial that we face, every one that we go through, adds depth and meaning. Every trial contributes to our purification process. In addition to the endless life that will be awarded to us if we're victorious, eternal life has its foundation. As its foundation, the idea of a different quality of life. Revelation 4 and verse 10 perhaps explains this figure of speech better as crown of life. In the vision that John is having, he sees the 24 elders worshiping the one that is sitting on the throne. and they cast their crowns before that throne. That symbol of victory for a Christian is neither a laurel crown or a crown with jewels, but rather it is a crown of a life that has been purified and perfected by the trials of life, a life which is its own crown, and which someday can be cast in praise before the throne of God. That is the kind of life that is the only trophy which can be presented to God, the only one. This means that we are to count our many blessings, and that our many blessings and our many trials are closer to the same than we would ever suspect. The Bible tells us to put trials down on the credit side of the ledger of life and to be thankful for them. Our trials refine us, and our trials turn us to God. A man by Sidney Lanier, he was a man who had been ravaged by disease. But he found a faith that enabled him to write, "As the marsh hen secretly builds on the watery sod, behold, I will build me a nest on the greatness of God." Our trials are coming. We will face them each and every day of our life to some degree or another. They be me minor, they can be major, but they're going to be there. Our attitude toward them will determine whether they will break us or they will make us and give us that crown that we so desire. If there is anyone here this evening who is in need of the prayers of the congregation or ones who would like to turn their life over to God by obeying the gospel, we want to give you that opportunity tonight. If anybody has a need, won't you come as together we stand and we sing.